taxpayers.
Okay, it's lecture number 8, marriage and divorce. Lecture number 8, marriage and divorce. This is a very touchy subject within the church. I think we need to have a little bit more compassion on issues like this than we have shown as a church in America in the past. But the family is society's most important unit. Yet today, more than half of the marriages in the United States end in divorce. So there's definitely a big problem that is occurring. The biblical view of marriage is, first off, is between a man and a woman. There is no, again, it comes right back to one man and one woman for one lifetime. You don't have this lesbian or homosexual marriages being condoned in the scriptures. It's between a man and a woman. Genesis 1, 27 and 28 says, "And God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Well, that was before the fall. So the male and the female that God had created was Adam and Eve. And he told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and all. And that's what God did. God created a male and a female. Take a look at Genesis 2:24. "For this cause, the man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Okay? So a man takes his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Not a man and a man. Not a woman and a woman. But a man and a woman. Now when Jesus quotes this in Matthew 19, he quotes it as the two shall become one flesh. In Matthew 19, verses 4 to 6, "And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Not the 35, you know, one guy and his 34 wives, or the 1,001, Solomon and his 300 wives and his 700 concubines. No, that was not within God's perfect plan. God's perfect plan is one man and one woman for one lifetime. Verse 6, "Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh, what therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." And so the biblical view of marriage is between a man and a woman. It involves a sexual union. Genesis 2:24 says that they become one flesh, and it's also quoted there in Matthew 19. The two become one flesh. It's talking about the sexual union. 1 Corinthians 7. Take a look at 1 Corinthians 7. Corinthians 7, verses 2 to 4. Let's start with verse 1. "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does." And he says in verse 5, "Stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control." And then a little later, verse 7, he basically says, look, I think you guys would be a lot better off if you don't get married. You get married and things are going to be tough. You can't just, you know, it's like when some of you bachelors come over to my house and say, hey, let's go catch a movie. Let's go get a bite to eat and this and that. It's like, I got to check with the missus first. And I got to keep in peace at home is the number one priority here. And the bachelors usually don't understand that until about after the first year of marriage, they recognize that all of a sudden there's a lot of give and take that takes place in a marriage to make a marriage work. Kurt Rainier, future divorcee. So Paul's saying, being single is easier. I recommend that you do that. But if you're getting tempted towards in a sexual area, it'd be best for you to get married. If you can't, if you have a drive in that area, it'd be best for you to be married. And then when you get married, the husband shouldn't deprive himself, deprive the wife of sex, nor should the wife deprive the husband. So it involves a sexual union. It involves the raising of children. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, we spoke about that. It involves the union, Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. But it also involves pleasure. Look at Proverbs chapter 5, verses 18 and 19. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. There are certain religious leaders who would say that if the wife can no longer bear children, the husband and wife should get separate beds and cease to have sexual relations. That is not the case. God, the primary reason for the husband and the wife to come together, the primary reason is the pleasure, the intimacy, the becoming totally one with one another. At the same time, the greatest blessing that comes from that is, some people don't view them as blessings, but the children, the offspring that you can bear there. But there is pleasure involved, and there's nothing sinful about the pleasure between one man and one woman for one lifetime and sharing everything together. Marriage involves a covenant. Look at Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14. Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. So it involves a covenant, an agreement, a pact, a vow made to one another till death do us part, for better, for worse. You better, when a guy marries a woman and a woman marries a guy, you better love that person you're with. And you better love them completely. I believe, and some preachers would give different advice, and I think they're wrong. I believe if you marry a woman, and right after you marry her, you go outside, and they throw the rice on you, and you get into your just married vehicle, and you drive down the road, and a drunk driver slams into your vehicle, and your wife gets paralyzed from the neck down, and she could not have sexual relations with you. I believe that it's God's will for you to remain married. That's for better, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health. I believe even if the marriage wasn't consummated, that basically you're to remain in that marriage with that woman, and so you better love the whole woman, every aspect of her being. Another thing is too is it involves a companionship. When you look at that verse 14, the wife of your youth, she is your companion and your wife by covenant. I recommend the Christian guys become friends with Christian girls. Don't worry about the dating thing. Become friends. And then, when you're so close as friends, that even if you asked this lady, young lady out, and she said no, it wouldn't hurt your feelings. When you're that close to her as friends, that's the type of relationship you want. Those, if you build a strong friendship, then anything else can go wrong in that marriage. But based on your mutual love in Jesus and that strong friendship that you have, you know, the day's going to come, no matter how beautiful she is and how handsome he is, the day's going to come when his chest is going to sink and sag down to his gut. He's going to have wrinkles. She's going to have wrinkles. That dark hair that you had is going to be all gray. And you're not going to have the energy to do a lot of the things you used to like doing, maybe going camping or whatever and stuff. And after having you around the house for 40 or 50 years, your wife probably won't make your favorite dish once a week like she used to. If you're lucky, you'll get it once every 3 years, whatever. And in the end, the only thing you might have left is that friendship, that mutual love of Jesus and that friendship. And with my wife and I, in our marriage vows, we vowed to be best friends next to Jesus. Only Jesus is a closer friend to me than my wife. And you can lose it all. You can lose everything. But if that woman is your best friend next to Jesus, she'll be with you through thick or thin, and you'll be with her no matter what. And I tell you, I wouldn't have a marriage. Marriage without Jesus, I think, would be... To me, I think it would be torture on earth, because it's just two imperfect people trying to learn to live together despite each other's faults. But being married with Jesus and doing things His way, and I've got a wife that wants to do things Jesus' way, and I'm blessed in that area. Marriage is a beautiful thing. And marriage will enable a man to be all that God called him to be. If a godly woman encourages him, encourages her man, and tremendous things can happen. But marriage involves a covenant, and it involves companionship. It also involves two people. Remember where it said, Matthew 19, 4-6, where the two shall become one flesh, is what Jesus said. Also, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2, we read it earlier. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. You notice it didn't say let each man have his own wives, and let each woman have her own husbands? You see, polygamy, God permitted it at times, but it was never within God's perfect plan. Marriage, the biblical view of marriage involves two people. Polygamy is wrong. In fact, in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, the elder is supposed to be the husband of one wife. Not two, not three, not ten. Husband of one wife. Now, it's not that something more is expected out of the elder. It's just that the elder is supposed to be a godly man, a well-rounded godly man, so that he sets the example for the flock. So that everybody should have the characteristics of the elder and the deacon. But he should be the husband of one wife. And again, polygamy is wrong. It also involves a lifelong commitment, till death do us part. None of this, some of these, I've heard some real bogus vows. That if you go into debt, it gives me an out. And that type of thing. And but take a look at Romans chapter 7, verse 2. It involves a lifelong commitment. For the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law concerning the husband. Till death do us part. Okay? Also, Jesus said, "What God has joined together, let no man separate." Another thing, though, is that marriage is not eternal. Regardless of what the Mormons tell you, marriage is not eternal. I don't care if they put their Mormon underwear on and got married in the temple. It's not eternal. Matthew 22 and verse 30. Matthew 22:30. For in the resurrection, Christ is talking about the resurrection, but that for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And it's like John MacArthur said about this passage. He said, okay, so I won't be married to my wife in heaven, and we won't be having the sexual union in heaven that we enjoy now. At the same time, I think it'll be right, okay, in my free time, but I don't think the Lord would mind if I chase my wife all over the universe. And what he basically saying is he can still be friends with his wife throughout all eternity. But the Lord is not going to have us have the sexual union and the marriage in the resurrection that occurs here now. So that's the biblical view of marriage. It involves a man and a woman. It involves a sexual union, the raising of children. It involves pleasure. It involves a covenant and companionship. It involves two people. It involves a lifelong commitment, though it is not eternal. The next three issues I want to cover here about the marriage and divorce is, number one, the Christian views, different Christian views of divorce. What are the different Christian views of divorce? Then I want us to look at the different Christian views of remarriage after divorce. Some guys can give you the thumbs up, you can get divorced, but you get thumbs down when it comes to getting remarried. And then the question comes up, can a divorced man become a pastor? What does it mean to be a husband of one wife? Okay? I'm going to talk to different options. I'll let you know my view. You can agree or disagree. It's irrelevant to me, although, again, whatever view you hold to, if you really believe that's what the Bible teaches, stick to it. But if you do counsel a person in that area, counsel with a lot of love, because these are areas that can hurt people very, very much. Christian views of divorce, three basic areas of agreement in the church today is that divorce is not God's ideal, it's not God's perfect will. All Christians pretty much agree on that. They also agree that divorce is not permissible for every cause. Oh, well, we're just not compatible, we don't see eye to eye. You hear that over and over, that gets me sick. One of my sergeants at work said that once to me, because I feel so bad for you, I heard you getting a divorce. And the guy said, yeah, we just weren't compatible, you know, just that thrill was gone. And it's like, I'm thinking to myself, man, that guy makes me want to vomit. It's so weak. I mean, everybody says that kind of thing, and it's like, you know, it's almost like, sounds horrible, but it's almost like saying, yeah, I got tired of the old lawnmower, now I'm going to go get a newer one. Or I got tired of the old car. They're talking about human beings as if it's just a thing, just an object. And not just a human being, but the human being that this guy's supposed to love above all other human beings. And they say, well, we're just not compatible and this and that. And lo and behold, before his divorce is even final, he's dating somebody else on the job site and living with the lady. Three areas of agreement in church. Divorce is not God's ideal. It's not God's perfect will. It's not permissible for every cause. And there's agreement in the church that divorce creates problems. It creates problems between the couple. It creates problems for children. It creates problems for friends. They don't know, well, if I say hello to Harry, is Sally going to get mad? You know, is she going to start hating me? But divorce creates problems. The differing views in the church. There is no biblical grounds for divorce view. There's absolutely no biblical grounds whatsoever for divorce. That's one view. They would point to Mark chapter 10 verses 1 to 9. Mark chapter 10 verses 1 to 9 and Luke 6:18, which lists no exceptions. It says if you get divorced, if you divorce someone, in fact, let me turn there to Mark chapter 10 verses 1 to 9, get the terminology correct here. Starting in verse 7. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, there are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. And so, in this passage, it does not seem to give any exception whatsoever. Same as Luke 6:18. Now, the problem is in Matthew 19, verses 1 to 9, the passage we already covered, it said that if a man divorces his wife and marries another, except in cases of immorality, he commits adultery. So there's an exception there, okay? Now, what some hold to, and this group where they say no biblical grounds for divorce, what they say is there the immorality occurs before, yeah.
Luke 6:18.
Yeah, I might have wrote the wrong verse though.
So,
what does Luke 6:18 say?
Who had come to hear him and be healed of their disease with those troubled by demon spirits or cured.
Yeah, it does sound like that's the wrong passage, doesn't it? Luke 6:18. Yeah. Yeah, that is the wrong passage. Let's probably just get every different variation there. We'll figure it out. I mean, it might be Luke 16:18. Who knows? Anyway, just cross that one. Strike that one out. But in Matthew 19...
The 16:18.
Okay, Luke 16:18 then. In Matthew 19, there is an exception given, and it's for immorality. You can divorce and remarry and not commit adultery if there's immorality done by your mate. Now, what these guys argue, they say there's no biblical grounds for divorce. They would argue that this divorce is done before the two people come together. This divorce is done while they were just engaged. Okay, the Jews would get what we would consider engaged. They consider that like being married, but they wouldn't have sex with each other for a whole year. And if during that period she committed immorality with somebody, or there was evidence that she had committed immorality with somebody before, he could then divorce her and would be free to remarry somebody else because he hadn't had sexual union yet. And so that's the view there. There's no biblical grounds for divorce. That's one view. A second view in the church today is that adultery is the only ground for divorce. Okay? Adultery is the only ground for divorce. Matthew 19:1-9, where the immorality is mentioned there, and Matthew 5:32. This school of thought seems to hold to that if your spouse breaks the marriage bond and commits adultery and will not repent, then that would break the marriage bond and then you would be free to remarry. Now what this group would be saying is that whenever there's divorce, there is always sin involved, yet that does not mean that both parties were necessarily at fault. One could be the innocent party that the other party was unfaithful to, and then that would free them to remarry. It's also mentioned in Matthew 5:32. So that's a second view. A third view is that there's several grounds for divorce. Several grounds for divorce. This school of thought would say that you could divorce for adultery, Matthew 19:1-9, but also 1 Corinthians 7:15, desertion by an unbeliever. 1 Corinthians 7:15, Paul says this about marriage. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Paul says, if you're married to a non-believer, and the non-believer wants to stay, let him stay. Make the marriage work. But if they want to leave, if they want to divorce you, let them divorce you. You're no longer caught. You're no longer held in bondage to them in that situation. So some would say not only adultery, but also desertion by an unbeliever. Then might also use the greater good. Remember we talked about the greater good, the graded absolutism, where yes, it is good to remain married, but sometimes it might be even a greater good to remove yourself from an evil person. And some people might apply that and might say, hey, what if you're married to somebody and you find out they're a serial murderer? Wouldn't it be better to divorce in a case like that? Ephesians 5:24, wives are commanded to submit to their husbands in everything. That's the command. Well, what if the husband commands the wife to kill somebody, to kill an innocent person? Well, then obviously, since that command is an absolute command, the greater good is going to come into effect. She's going to receive an exemption, not an exception. There's no exceptions to the rule. The rule remains intact, but she's going to receive an exemption from having to obey that rule in that particular case. Okay? So the greater good would come in there. Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, tells us that we have to submit to the governing authorities. But there are cases when the apostles didn't submit to the governing authorities. Such as when it was against the law for them to preach the gospel. So, maybe the greater good would come into play. Maybe there would be certain cases where it would be a greater good to divorce rather than to stay in a marriage with either a murderer or an adulterer or something along those lines. So that third group would hold to something like that. Now that's just the okay for divorce. The question comes up, are they free to remarry after divorce? Yes.
These are just as far as the church and spiritual, right? This doesn't cover like the financial aspect where if today someone leaves them enough, they go to get a divorce and they take the person to the, they make sure that other person doesn't get a thing financially. Mm-hmm. This is just abuse spiritual, right?
Well,
or is that?
This just isn't talking about literally, getting divorced in your mate or whatever, but those other issues, one of the big problems we have in the state is a thing called no-fault divorce. So that a woman can work 70, 80 hours a week at a truck stop as a waitress to put her husband through medical school, and then once he's through 12 or 13 years of medical school and he's got a high-paying job, he can leave her for his nurse. And as far as Washington State is concerned, that's no-fault divorce. So in other words, the blame that the Washington State doesn't say, you ruthless slob, and then demand that this guy repay the woman for all the schooling that she paid for, and then take maybe half of a salary for the rest of his life and pay to her. They don't say that. They don't say, well, you're the one who left her. You're the one who was unfaithful. Washington State acts like there's no such thing as right and wrong, and it's irrelevant who tried to be a good mate. And one thing too, there's a lot of other complicated issues that are going on today that weren't going on back then. There have been husbands who have always beaten their wives throughout history, but at the time Christ was speaking, it was almost unheard of for a woman to divorce her husband. They just didn't have that freedom. They're almost considered property of their husband. Whereas nowadays, I could see a lot of ladies divorcing their husbands because that's the only thing they could do to save their lives, because the guy is just literally wolfing the tar on them. But anyway, that's a different Christian view. Some say no grounds for divorce. Others say adultery is the only ground for divorce. And I was saying there's several grounds for divorce.
Is there a verse that goes along with the greater good? Somebody said something about when you suffer from a rock in a hard place, it's the greater good.
They were just the passages that we referred to where Jesus admitted that he worked on the Sabbath to heal.
Okay.
And then when they threw that at him, he said, look, you guys will circumcise a guy with the eighth day of his life full on the Sabbath. So you guys will be willing to break the Sabbath law because of a greater good. But, you know, whether or not Geiger doesn't apply that, by the way, Geiger seems to favor, I think he seems to favor the no biblical grounds for divorce, although I think he sees that you can divorce and not remarry and not be guilty of adultery. Okay? The Christian views of remarriage after divorce, one view is that it's forbidden, you know, a God is joined together, let no man separate, Matthew 19:1-9. So one says that remarriage after divorce is forbidden. Another Christian view is that only if the partner was unfaithful, adultery. And they go to the same passage, Matthew 19:1-9, and interpret a little differently and say, well, the immorality there, if the partner was unfaithful, that breaks the marriage bond, and it gives you the freedom to remarry. Another group says, well, only in the cases of adultery or desertion by an unbeliever, and they refer to 1 Corinthians 7:15. Now the thing is, they make a pretty good case for this, because in Romans 7, well, in 1 Corinthians 7:15, listen to the language here, yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. So you're moved from the bond. So everybody agrees you can allow them to divorce you there, the unbelievers. But can you remarry? Well, then we come to Romans chapter 7 and verse 2. It says, for the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living, but if her husband dies, she is released from the law concerning her husband. She's bound by law while he's alive. The bondage is removed. When he dies, she's free to remarry. Well, if the bondage is removed here when the non-believer leaves the believer, does that also mean now that the bondage is gone, they're free to remarry? You can make a pretty good case for that. That is also a possibility. So some would say only if the partner was unfaithful, you know, adultery. Others would say adultery or unbeliever desertion. Others would say if a divorcee was innocent. Not that they were perfect, but they tried to make it work and the other maid just didn't. Others would even say if a divorcee is repentant. Our God's a God of a second chance. Once He forgives us, our sins are gone. And they would say, well, in those cases, you know, since God has forgiven you, who are we to bring up your past? You know, I wish I had jotted it down, but there's a passage in Deuteronomy, I think around chapter 32 or somewhere in that area, where the Old Testament forbids someone to divorce their spouse. No, I don't think it's going to be there. Who knows, maybe it is. But the Old Testament forbids you to divorce your spouse, remarry somebody else, and then either divorce them or they die, and then go back to your spouse that you were married to before. Okay? Which seems to say that if, whether it's justified or not, if you're divorced and your spouse remarries somebody else, you're no longer bonded to them, you're not free to remarry them, and that would seem to set you free to remarry somebody else. So even if there was a divorce for less than biblical reasons, if your spouse was to remarry or even to live in an adulterous relationship with somebody else, some would say that would break the marriage bond and would free you to then remarry. Whatever the case is, there's a lot of debate about these.
That wouldn't be Deuteronomy 21,
is it 21:24?
Well, chapter 24 got something on it, like that, and he's also
kind of going. What does 24 say? Deuteronomy 24, the first few verses. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies and took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. You should not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. So, if there is a divorce and the person remarries or you remarry, and then that marriage ends, you're not free to go back, which seems to mean that a marriage after a divorce would seem to break the bond with that person. In other words, if you got divorced and your spouse remarried somebody else, you could never hope that that spouse will come back to you. Therefore, you'll be free to remarry. Now, let me say something here. This is where we've got to have some compassion. Let's say we got two 15-year-old girls, and they both get pregnant. Neither one of them is a Christian. They both get pregnant, okay? One of them doesn't have an ounce of morality in her, so she gets pregnant and has a baby, but then she also has sex with 50 other different guys by the time she's 20, and then she becomes a Christian. This other girl is 15, she gets pregnant, but she's got some morality, some moral backbone, so she talks to the guy and convinces the guy to marry her, so they get married, and then he runs off with somebody else when she's 16. But when she's 20, she accepts the Lord, but she hasn't had sex with anybody else. Okay? If we say that you cannot divorce and remarry, okay, the girl that didn't get married but had sex with 50 different guys, the average preacher would say to her, you should go find yourself a good godly husband to raise that child. But then they would say to the other one, only had sex with one man who divorced her, you can never remarry, you have to stay celibate for the rest of your life, and your child, Jesus will take care of your child, he's not going to provide a father. So we have to be real careful where we stand on these issues. And yeah, you can be punished for being more upright in a certain situation. So it's one of those things, there's no easy answers. We need a lot of prayer, we need a lot of compassion. Our God is a God of second chance. How far you take that, I don't know for sure. All I can say is if you're in a marriage now, make it work. If you're not married now, and maybe you had a marriage that was destroyed in the past, if you really feel that you need to be married and you really prayed about it, I'd say give it a lot of time, but really make sure that the next marriage you go into, really make sure that it works. But I'm not going to be the guy that commands a 15 or 16-year-old girl that you can never get married as long as you live, nor am I going to be the one who tells, there's some guys that would tell a couple to get divorced and return to their former spouses, which is a direct contradiction to what Deuteronomy says there. Anyway, can a divorced man become a pastor? In order to be a pastor, or even a deacon, you must be the husband of one wife, it says in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2. Literally, it means a one-woman man. There's differing views. One says that means you can never be divorced.
What was that verse again?
1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2. One view says that it means that you can never be divorced. Another view says, no, you can be divorced, but you just can't be remarried. Because then it would entail a second wife. Another view would say, no, what it's talking about is you can't be a bigamist or a polygamist, somebody who marries more than one person. And the view that I hold is that you cannot be unfaithful to your present spouse. You've got to be, in other words, to be a, God is more concerned about your present character than he is about your past history. Every other qualification for the elder deals with present character, not past history. Therefore, what God is most concerned about is not whether you were divorced 7 or 8 times as a non-believer, but what God is concerned about is, are you faithful to your present wife and are you going to be with her for better or for worse, till death do us part, do everything in your power to make it work. Because if that is the case, you're a one, you're a one-woman man, and you're faithful to your present spouse in thought and deed, and at least in that aspect, you'd be qualified. for the ministry. Okay, that's all we have time for there. Except to move it on out now.